Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the NoCellaCast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Apple bias. Today is Sunday, May 28th, 2017, and this is show number 629. Well, next week, Steve and I are headed off to finally see Yellowstone and Grand Teton National Parks with our friends Bill and Diane. We leave on Thursday, so the NoCellaCast will actually come out super early next week on Wednesday night. That way, we are not going to break our streak. Now, for those of you who enjoy coming to the live show, there obviously will not be one next week. That doesn't mean you can't go hang out in the live chat room without us, of course. From what I can understand, and I gather during the show, no one pays attention to my blather anyway. You guys just like to talk to each other. Steve did send out a note this week on social media suggesting that you guys can certainly hang out together in the live chat room during WWDC on Tuesday, June 5th at 10 a.m. We normally love to do that. It's really fun to sit there and whine about the feed or, you know, complain about the lag or something like that or whatever's been announced. But obviously, we're going to be on the road and unable to join. But again, that shouldn't stop you guys from having fun in there. If you want to join in and you haven't played in the live show before, the easiest way is to just go to podfeet.com/live. And there's a web-based web-based chat client. I kind of compressed two words there. Web-based chat client in there. And there's links to tutorials on how to set up standalone clients, too, if you want to use one of those. Of course, the video on that page will not be live. That always confuses people. They think somehow I'm going to pipe the announcement video in, or you're going to watch me sitting there watching TV, but that's not what we do. But the live chat room should be fun. We're sorry to be missing it, but hopefully you'll keep us informed of anything we miss. I'm guessing usually Stephen Getz is the one who will start pinging me saying, "Oh my gosh, did you see what they said?" Anyway, should be fun. Well, this week's Chit Chat Across the Pond was actually a new episode of Taming the Terminal. When I split off the propeller beanie and light versions of Chit Chat, it didn't occur to me that this would actually happen. So when I said propeller beanie, I actually meant programming by stealth is what I had split off. So now there's the main Chit Chat feed that has everything, or you can subscribe separately to Chit Chat Across the Pond Light, or Programming by Stealth, or Taming the Terminal, or all three individually if you just like to have them in separate feeds. And remember, if you change nothing, you will still get all of the Chit Chat goodness in the main feed, no matter what flavor it is. So anyway, in this episode of Taming the Terminal, Bart teaches us about SSH clients, I'm sorry, SSH agents, and how to regain some capability with them that we lost in upgrading to El Capitan. Personally, I hadn't noticed we'd lost it, but once Bart explained it to me, I understand that I deeply missed it. Bart does a great job of reminding us what we learned about in SSH back in parts 29 and 30 of Taming the Terminal, because that was a long time ago. So that way it's easier for us all to get back up to speed and follow along with his new instructions. Go check out Taming the Terminal either in the Taming the Terminal feed or in the regular Chit Chat Across the Pond feed in your podcatcher of choice. Lately, I've run into a slew of tech problems, finding bugs in just about everything, hardware and software. This has given me the opportunity, and I put that in air quotes, to compare reactions from companies when I tell them about problems. I would normally write a huge diatribe about those that didn't meet my expectations, and I actually will be talking about that later, but instead, right now, I'm going to tell you about the gold standard in support. That company is Rogue Amoeba, the makers of Audio Hijack, amongst other tools. I've talked about Audio Hijack quite a bit on the show, but to bring everybody up to speed on it, it's the absolute center point of how I create the podcast. Audio Hijack, as the name implies, hijacks the audio on your Mac, allowing you to route it around in interesting ways. I create the podcast recordings completely without a complicated hardware mixer that a lot of other people use. With the Audio Hijack, I can capture the audio of a Skype call and my voice on two separate tracks, add effects like an equalizer and a compressor. I can route the audio back to my headphones so I can monitor my own voice for any problems along with that of my partner on the show. I can also send the audio to a recorder to capture an uncompressed audio file. Audio Hijack is positively essential for the creation of the Podfeet podcast. The live show pretty much wouldn't work without it. I use it and a couple other tools from Rogue Amoeba in order to pipe my audio, Steve's audio, out to Nicecast for the audio-only feed and over to the video. And it's absolutely essential. It's one of my favorite applications. Well, last week, Rogue Amoeba pushed out update 3.3.3 of Audio Hijack. I know I should read the release notes on something so critical to my process before installing an update, but when I do that, I find I rarely understand what developers say they've done anyway, so I was just blindly hit update, because not updating is usually more dangerous than updating. Well, last Friday, Bart and I jumped on Skype to do a recording of Programming by Stealth. Immediately, I told him his audio was horrible. It was clipped and overmodulated. It was like having shards of glass driven into my ears. All right, that might be a bit of an exaggeration, but trust me, it was not what you'd have wanted to listen to. I asked him to check all of his settings first. While doing this kind of recording, there are so many different places your audio gets controlled. On his end, at the very least, his input volume and mic selection was controlled by the macOS sound preference pane, and Skype has duplicate controls that have to be checked. Skype also has a feature, and that again is in air quotes, and that actually amplifies your volume randomly without warning. We always shut it off, but sometimes it gets turned back on, especially when there's an update, and we made sure that feature was shut off. We did a screen share so I could see what he was fiddling with, but the audio was still awful. We both quit and restarted Skype, which often clears many ills. No joy. I quit Audio Hijack and restarted it. I restarted both Skype and Audio Hijack. I even restarted my Mac. Still no joy. Finally, I tried quitting Audio Hijack, but staying in the Skype call, and suddenly Bart's audio was perfect. It looked like we had narrowed the problem down to Audio Hijack as the root cause. But to be sure it wasn't something weird in my computer, my complex Audio Hijack setting, I should say, I created a completely new recording session in Audio Hijack with just Skype into my headphones and into a recorder. As soon as I turned it on, the overmodulation of Bart's voice was back. By now, we'd been fiddling around for about an hour. Luckily, Bart likes diagnosing things as much as I do, but we figured we should get moving. Bart always does a backup recording, so we decided to rely on his version using Call Recorder. If you listened to Programming by Stealth last week, you heard beautiful audio from his end. Later that day, Steve and I sat down to do some more experiments. I wanted to 100% eliminate Bart's setup from the equation. I was 90% sure, but let's get to 100%. Steve and I got on a Skype call, and with Audio Hijack in the simplest configuration, his voice was overmodulated just like Bart's. I installed Skype Call Recorder. That's from Ecamm Networks, by the way, and it's a delightful little recorder, and I was able to record both sides of our conversation without issue. My final test was to eliminate my version of Skype as the root cause, because Skype is usually the root of all evils. I tried to record a FaceTime audio session with Steve using Audio Hijack 3.3.3, and the audio wouldn't even flow through the session, so there was nothing at all to record. Through these controlled tests, I had definitely proven that something was amiss with the recently released version of Audio Hijack. By now, you're wondering why I said at the beginning that Rogue Amoeba is the gold standard, because obviously they got a problem here. Well, first of all, every software application has bugs, all of them. Every piece of hardware has problems. It's all in how you're treated when something goes wrong. That's how I really judge a software or hardware vendor. My biggest complaint with many software vendors is that after I do vast experiments to be sure I'm right, and I produce videos and screenshots showing where the problem is, they so often write back with dumb answers like uninstall and reinstall the application, or I didn't bother to review your video. It happens all the time. And that's when they even respond to me. They also often take a really, really, really long time to respond. Now, let's talk about what the gold standard is like. First of all, Audio Hijack 3.3.3 was released in part to fix another bug I'd found. It wasn't a critical one, but some of my Audio Hijack session windows refused to be resized. Rogue Amoeba fixed that in 3.3.3, so I call it the Allison session resizing version. So it's my own fault, right? Well, anyway, let's get back to what happened with this particular bug. On Friday night at 5:30 p.m., so remember the timing here, Friday night at 5:30 p.m., I wrote to Rogue Amoeba describing the problem I'd found in detail, explaining to them each of the steps I'd taken to replicate the problem. I fully expected, since it was Friday night, I wouldn't hear from them till Monday. Surprisingly, the most awesome Chris Barajas from Rogue Amoeba wrote back to me at 9:22 a.m. on Sunday. Only 36 hours have passed on a weekend, and Rogue Amoeba was on the job. Chris had clearly checked out the audio file I'd attached so he could hear the clipping, and he'd seen the visual aid I'd provided showing a screenshot of the squared-off waveform that had been recorded. Just the fact that he paid attention to what I sent was a breath of fresh air. I answered his questions at 11 p.m. on Sunday night. By Monday morning at 8:19 a.m., Chris wrote back with the most wonderful response. He explained they'd included a new audio capture back end in release 3.3.3 and a quirk in it. I would have said bug, but let's not quibble about that. Anyway, this quirk was causing the problem. So far, Rogue Amoeba is ahead of everyone else by A, reading, watching, listening to my test, and B, acknowledging and finding the root cause. but he also included in his note a way to disable this new backend audio engine. He said I could launch Audio Hijack with the Option key held down, and that would reveal the bug debugging window. In the hidden preferences that come up, you can enable Use Old Style Hijacker. I felt so special having the secret menu. Well, I tested out the fix of disabling the hijacker and using the old style one, and sure enough, reverting to it gave me beautiful audio from Skype. Not only did Rogue Amoeba acknowledge the problem and find the root cause, they gave me a band-aid to hold me over. I was so excited, I posted a screenshot of the explanation and a solution to the Facebook groups for both NoSilicast and MacGeekGab, just in case someone stumbled into the same problem. Now remember that band-aid solution was at 8:19 a.m. on Monday morning. Well, I needn't have posted to the Facebook group so quickly, because by 1:40 p.m. on Monday, Rogue Amoeba had released Audio Hijack 3.3.4, reverting the engine back to the old-style hijacker for everyone. Interestingly, they did this by shipping that version with the old-style hijacker selected in the secret menu. Total time elapsed from when I wrote to Rogue Amoeba until the problem was fixed was 68 hours, and that included 48 hours of a weekend. They acknowledged my email, asked questions, determined the root cause, sent me a temporary fix, and reverted their code to fix the problem for everyone. Unbelievable. I wrote to Chris and I told him that Rogue Amoeba is the gold standard, and he showed utter humility at what I'd said. He wrote, "Thanks for bearing with us and for the positivity, even when we're at less than our best. We'll work towards a smoother set of updates going forward." That brings tears to my eyes. Sure, it would have been awesome if they hadn't made a mistake in the first place, but mistakes always happen. My real happiness here was how well they took care of the problem. That comes from a culture built from the top down in a company. I can't compliment Rogue Amoeba enough, and I better mention one thing. In case you're wondering, Rogue Amoeba is not a paid sponsor and never has been. Rogue Amoeba doesn't just make high-end recording apps. They've also probably got something else you need. Check them out at rogueamoeba.com. If you can't spell it, there's a link in the show notes. And also check out Airfoil, Fission, Loopback, Nicecast, Piezo, and they've got one called SoundSource. And I got to go figure out what is SoundSource. I got to go check that one out. Let's listen to another interview from NAB 2017. We like 360 cameras, and the one Steve likes in particular is the Theta S from Ricoh. And we have Kazunobu Saiki here to tell us about a new product, but I think it's going to be a bit of a tease of a product. He's not going to tell us too much, but it's enough to get us excited.
Right. Thanks you. We are very proud to showcase our new generation Theta. This one has we here announced four major features. This one will be equipped 4K 30 frames per second movie functions. And then something very new is a spatial audio. So this machine can record audio with the directions. So the 3D audio or spatial audios that will be coupled with the movie.
And then when the audio is moving around with you, that can really make it much more compelling, right?
So that will give the really nice excitement for the 360 world. So if you use head-mount displays, just an example, then sound direction will be very visible. So when you turn, you see exactly the subject which making that sound. So this is probably very nice features and very new feature. And then this machine also have the 4K live streaming features, so everybody can start to make a 4K live streaming. And then also this machine is actually Android based OS is implemented.
Okay.
That's why somebody can program the application which can be plugged in onto this Theta firmware. So the various kind of functionality could be expanded.
So you have an API then for it?
Yeah, of course, we should open the API interface. Then because of Android basis, a lot of developers could make their own desired applications.
Right. Now, all of this stuff that you've described, it looks like the same form factor as the Theta S. Is it going to look pretty much the same?
This is, of course, a prototype, but we do believe the final product will be very close to the style.
Now, we really like the Theta because of the form factor. Right. A lot of them are balls, and you can't stick that in your pocket. You can't put it anywhere. And right. The Theta S is a thin, flat piece that's a lot easier to hold in your hand.
We know every user appreciates this form factor. And then this form factor is really nice for the always with you. This is one point because of the slimness or because of the compactness. But another point is due to this form factor, two lenses could be very close to each other. That makes the areas which we can't detect the data is minimized.
Right, right.
That's the reason why stretching accuracy is very much good
with
the competitors, right?
Right,
this
right.
This is also coming from this form factor.
That's one of the things that we always amaze people because they ask us, well, I don't understand how it works. Mm-hmm. We explain them it's these two hemispheres with this very thin layer in between that disappears when it stitches it in camera. And that's already impressive.
Yeah.
So the one disappointment, if we had anything, was that the resolution wasn't as high as we wanted. Mm-hmm. So when you say it's 4K, 30 frames per second.
30 frames per second.
So what will the stills look like? What will the resolution?
Still, remains unchanged, 4K.
The still photos will be 4K.
Still image, right?
Images.
Yeah, stay unchanged with the Theta S.
Oh, you're saying so that'll be lower resolution then?
No. Not the lower resolutions, but how to say? Because of the JPEG, right?
Oh, right. But I mean the size, not the megabytes.
I see.
The resolution of the photo, the resulting
size
photo.
Of the format.
Do you know what that will be?
Of course, that is improved, but we are not disclosing the information at this stage.
Okay.
Yeah.
Now, I think I know the answer to this, but what is it called?
What is the name?
Name of it.
Not named yet.
It's not named yet. Okay.
That's why I said the new generation Theta. But definitely one of the Theta series.
Okay. Here's another question I think you're not going to answer. Yeah. When can we have it?
Later this year.
Later this year? Okay, that's not too bad. And how much will it cost?
That we are still considering. What should be the position?
Okay, well, maybe for Christmas, Steve. We'll take a look at what this is going to do. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you very much.
Well, in the live chat room here, we're talking about things that are announced that may never come out. Luckily, Ricoh does have a history of having actual products and good actual products. So we're helpful that Ricoh Theta model yet to be defined actually comes out someday. And we're probably going to wait to replace the one was stolen from Steve in Peru. But anyway, that was a little frustrating of an interview to have so little information. Hopefully it'll be cool though. Well, earlier I told you the story of how Rogue Amoeba was so terrific responding to me about a bug I found in the recording engine for Audio Hijack. I stand by my praise of them. I also mentioned it would have been ideal if the problem hadn't happened in the first place. Because I have to say, recently, I feel like I am personally in charge of quality assurance for all of the things. Let me explain. About a month ago, I was working on a video for Don McAllister's Screencast Online, all about modifying Finder settings, to make it operate the way you like. In the process of making the video, I found a couple of things that didn't work quite as I'd expected. So I called AppleCare, and my little friend, senior advisor Amy, was able to replicate the bugs. According to Amy, she was unable to find anyone else who had found that bug. I had to do my recording for Don, and I ended up splatting some text on screen that said, yeah, this is a bug, and Apple's confirmed I found it. Anyway, not exactly ideal for a video screencast, but it bothered me that I had to find a bug in macOS. I don't know, I just don't expect that. Well, my QA job is not confined to software. Remember a while back, my AirPods failed? When I took them into Apple, they saw something blue in the grill end and suggested I had gotten them wet. Of course, I hadn't, and I went home and I took a macro shot of the grill, and sure enough, there was blue crystalline growth on it. But it wasn't water damage. It was the battery leaking out of both headphones. I took them back to Apple and convinced them to replace both AirPods and the case. Guess what happened this week? The left AirPod started failing on me. Yep. Every once in a while, I'd put the AirPods in after spending, say, 4 to 12 hours in their charging case. I'd go off on my walk, and suddenly the left AirPod would send an alert to me shortly afterwards that it was already below 10% battery. And the next time, the AirPod would just charge completely fine. I took them back for the third time to Apple, and I got the left one replaced. We'll see how that goes over time. Well, next, let's talk about Ring for a moment. Remember I said I could go on a rant about a company? Well, I tried really hard all week not to give you this rant, but I can't stand it. I'm going to tell you what happened. This is not going to be a happy moment. Ring makes the fabulous video doorbell and the new floodlight cam. I did reviews of both of them, and I love them. I recently figured out that in addition to their great iOS app, they have a Mac app. Well, that's fantastic. I installed it and noticed right away that it didn't have the floodlight cam in the list of devices I could manage. I wrote to them right away, and they said, oh, we're working on it. It was kind of a frowny face, but not that big of a deal. Well, the other day, I had the Ring app open on my Mac, and I noticed that while I can't select the floodlight cam to see a live view, the floodlight cam was showing up in the motion detection list. That's where you've got recorded motion that you can see. There's a nice little play button right there asking to be clicked. But when I clicked it, the most unexpected thing happened. Instantly, Safari launched, opened two browser tabs, and began throwing pop-ups all over my screen. This was disturbing, to say the least, and even more disturbing was the URLs of the two tabs. The left one was from DoubleClick, which is an ad business run by Google, and the other one was Hotjar, which is a web analytics company. That's a company that helps you track your users. So for a company to whom I'm sharing my video camera, my video recordings with, tracking wasn't the first thing I was hoping they were doing. At this point, I asked Steve to try the software. He went to ring.com, you know, because I wanted to make sure it wasn't something on my machine. I want to make sure it actually came from them. We went to ring.com and he found the download links. But the page showed a typical Mac App Store image with the words download on the Mac App Store. But guess what? When he clicked it, it didn't take him to the App Store. It downloaded a zip file. Seriously, no way was Steve installing that zip file because he's too smart. I think he's smarter than me because I don't remember noticing this when I downloaded it a while back. I don't remember if they changed it or what the story was. So now I'm wondering, do I have spyware on my Mac? Even though I run an antivirus, Clam XAV, I ran Malwarebytes just to be sure. My Mac came back clean. Well, since Steve wouldn't play with me in this cesspool of a problem, I contacted my friend Pat Dangler. She has all of the Ring devices, and I figured she probably had already installed the Ring Mac app. And it turned out she had. I asked her to test it, and she was able to confirm that she gets the pop-ups and the tabs open to DoubleClick and Hotjar as well. I wrote to Ring, including a link to the video I'd made, which is in the show notes, by the way, if you'd like to see it, and it clearly shows the pop-ups and the two bad tabs. Their initial response was, get this, uninstall and reinstall the app. Are you kidding me? Well, I wrote back a response that suggested that was not a good response at all. I wasn't mean, but I was firm that this was a huge problem, that not only was it these pop-ups, but they also had this not a Mac App Store link that's downloading a zip file, and I wanted this taken seriously. After going back and forth with them for 6 days, I finally included the CEO, Jamie Siminoff, on distribution. We had met him at CES, so I had his email address. I got a response immediately from him saying that a new app would be out that day or the next day. Great news. But two things went wrong with that. They didn't change the misleading link on their download page. By the way, it's been 8 or 9 days, and that link still says Mac App Store link. And they didn't come out with a new version of that app that day or the next day. Over the course of the next few days, I got the most bizarre messaging I've ever seen from a company. In one email, I asked yet again about the pop-ups and the link to DoubleClick and asked if they'd figured out what was causing that aberrant behavior. The CEO responded with, "We don't have links to DoubleClick. We are not aberrant." Clearly, he had not watched my video demonstrating that they do have links to DoubleClick. This was after one of the other Ring people who was responding to me said she had showed my video to engineering and that they had confirmed the pop-ups in the bug. But things got even more bizarre. On May 25th, I got a message from the director of communications from Ring telling me that their Mac App Store app was approved. But when I asked them 2 days later why I couldn't find it in the store yet and why the download link was still not to the Mac App Store, the CEO told me, they decided not to pursue putting their app in the Mac App Store. Well, that was weird. He did say they're going to change the link ASAP on the downloads page to reflect that it's not a Mac App Store link. Now, seriously, that's a 30-second fix. I was watching a movie. I was watching Star Trek last week when somebody noted that there was a problem with the link that I had to look for Bart on my website. While watching TV, I fixed it. I mean, it was 30 seconds. That's all it takes. You take off that little image and you put a link there. That's all they have to do. Well, at the very least, the messaging from Ring has been awful. But I guess all companies aren't rogue amoeba, right? If there's good news in this story, it's that they did come out with a new Ring app, and it doesn't launch your web browser, and it doesn't open links to questionable sites and cover your screen with pop-ups. It's really cool to be able to view my floodlight cam from my Macintosh now. All right, let's switch back to complaining about Apple hardware again, shall we? This is fun. You may remember me telling you the story about how the iPad Pro keyboards had a failure that would cause them to not actually type on the iPads. Mine had that affliction, so I made an AppleCare appointment, and I tootled off to the store to have them replace it. When I got it home, though, every once in a while my iPad would go berserk. By that, I mean the different elements on screen would start blinking independently of each other. I put a video in the show notes so you can see it for yourself. When this kind of thing happens, a reasonable person would march right back to Apple and demand it be replaced again. But instead, I just kind of wished it to stop. After a couple of weeks of this happening every 3 or 4 days, I finally made another appointment at the Apple store. I was very surprised when my little friend Marco at Apple said, "Tell you what, we don't know now if it's your iPad or your keyboard, so let's just replace both." I was floored. I didn't think it was necessary, but, you know, who am I to argue? Turns out I should have argued. We set up the second iPad from a backup of the original iPad. Everything looked great till I got home. About an hour after I got it, the screen suddenly got horizontal lines through it, flickered a bit, and then the iPad rebooted. Unbelievable. I didn't think wishing this one would go away was a good strategy. I immediately made yet another AppleCare appointment. I mean, think about this. I've spent like 5 hours now trying to get this fixed. Over the course of the next day or so, the iPad screen would do something, the same bizarre things, and then reboot. Sometimes when I wasn't playing with it at all, I'd come back and it would tell me, yeah, I restarted. One time it even made a screeching sound while I had it in my hands before it rebooted. So I set up yet another AppleCare appointment and I trotted off to Apple a few days later. I was delighted that they assigned Marco to my case again because I wanted him to realize how weird this was. He gave me a third iPad Pro, which we backed up from the second iPad Pro that was a backup of the first iPad Pro. It's probably going to be fine, but I have to say I'm watching it with a doubtful eye, waiting for it to misbehave. Well, you know what? It's come to my attention recently that almost all of my friends are not seeing my shared activity from the Apple Watch. I get all of their notifications, but they can't see mine. They can't re-add me because we're already connected. It appears to have started when I was in Peru, and it would make sense if no one could see me, but some people can. You know what that means? I have to call Apple. Again. Well, I use a fantastic app called ScreenFlow from Telestream to record video screencasts for Don McAllister's Screencasts Online. And I love this software. I really, really do. Don recently told me they'd added a new feature that allows you to record iOS devices right into the screencast. This is a huge improvement from our previous method, which was to record in QuickTime, save the file, and then import into ScreenFlow. That's kind of a pain because you end up with two copies and then you're kind of like, well, I don't know if I should delete that old one. Video files are huge, but you've got another one inside it. It's just a real hassle and you have to detach the audio. It's real annoying. So it's way cooler to do it inside ScreenFlow. I was really excited about this feature. Well, in ScreenFlow, when you start a screen recording, you hit Command N to open the window to define your audio and video sources. Once you choose the audio and video sources, you hit the record button. You record for a while, stop, do some edits in the editor. Now, presumably, you would want to go record some more. You could hit Command N again, but if you use the software a lot, you get used to hitting Command Shift 2 to start a new recording because it always keeps the last settings you gave it. Except that's not what happens with the new iOS recording option. After you record once, the next time you record, the iOS video recording is deselected. That means if you forget to go back and check it each and every time, you will have recorded nothing but your voice, which is, of course, what happened to me. The good news is that Telestream was closer on the spectrum to rogue amoeba than to Ring in their response to my bug submittal. They wrote back right away asked for some clarification, and then responded that they were able to replicate the bug that I had found and told me they'd submit it for a fix in the next revision. Since there's a workaround, that's cool with me. Well, since I submitted that bug to Telestream, I found two more bugs in ScreenFlow, but you know, I gotta say I'm getting a little tired of writing up these bug reports. I don't want to be in charge of QA for all of the things, but if that is my job, I want a raise because it's exhausting. Next week, Chit Chat Across the Pond Lite is going to be a conversation with Bruce Wilson, Chief Technology Officer for Information Technology at Oak Ridge National Laboratory. I'm really excited about talking to him about the crazy cool work they're doing there on things like an ultrasonic clothes dryer and a method to convert carbon dioxide into ethanol. Wait, this is starting to sound propeller beanie. Hopefully I can have him keep it at a level I can understand. I'm a little worried. He's been sending me some equations with, chemistry equations. Anyway, the reason I'm bringing him up is because not only is he going to make a huge contribution by being a guest on the show, he also just became a patron of the Podfeet podcast. Nice alliteration, isn't it? Anyway, becoming a patron is one of the best ways to show your continued support of the shows. You can join Bruce and the other cool kids by going over to podfeet.com and tapping on the Support the Show button. From there, you'll see the Patreon button along with PayPal and Amazon for the affiliate links. Once you go into Patreon, you sign up with an account and you choose the amount you'd like to pledge. You're in complete control of how much money it is. I really appreciate all of you who have shown your support in this way, and especially Bruce for doing it just this week. Well, it's that time of the week again. It's time for Security Bits with Bart Bouchatz. How bad does it look this week, Bart?
Do you know, it's actually not too bad. A lot of the show notes are continuing to mop up the massive Uber mega story that was in the middle of breaking last time we recorded, which is the WannaCry ransomware. And we knew at the time, like we said as we were recording last time, this is happening right now. We're not going to cover it all. And that was indeed correct. All the subtlety. So the first bit of subtlety that I want to talk about is, I mean, it was literally breaking. I think you pointed me to a link about the kill switch just as we were about to record, and it didn't make enough sense for me to talk about it because it was being reported in the mainstream media, who were leaving out all of the subtlety, presumably because they didn't understand any of the subtlety.
I don't think they've done a terrible job this time, but yeah.
Yeah. So I understand what was going on with that now, which is good. So, a little bit of backstory, right? There's a cat and mouse. There's lots of different cat and mouse games that go on between malware authors and between security researchers and antivirus vendors. And one of those cat and mouse games involves a technique that antivirus companies like to use to figure out what malware is doing. So what they will do is they'll create a virtual machine. They'll install the malware into the VM, and they'll have this VM tricked out to have all sorts of analytics and basically to spy on what the malware does. So malware now tries to detect that it's in a lab, effectively, and then it goes dormant. So as soon as it thinks it's being spied on, it goes dormant. And one of the things that a lot of these spy labs do, or these virtual environments, is that they will intercept all the network traffic, because the malware is in a VM, so it's not on a real network, it's on a pretend network. And so they will answer with fake DNS replies to try trick the malware into using another IP address that's actually run by the antivirus company as their command and control. And so that way you get a look into what's going on the command and control channel.
Okay.
And a naive way of doing this, a really dumb way of doing this, is simply to try resolve a bogus DNS name. If it does resolve, you're probably in a lab, because on the real world, on actual planet Earth, that domain name doesn't belong to anyone.
Wait, say that one more time.
So a way to see if you're in a lab is to try do a DNS query that you know should fail.
Okay.
But if you're in a lab and the lab is answering with the IP address of the test machine for every DNS name, no matter what you're looking for, well, then you are going to get an answer for a fake DNS name.
So a DNS resolve would be like searching for boogersandsnot.com, and you check first to see if that exists. You know it doesn't exist. You ask for that. And if it gives you an IP address, you know this is a lab. Hey.
Yeah, I'm not in the real world, because in the real world, there is no boogersandsnot.com.
Okay.
So a smart way of doing this would be to randomly generate a stupidly long DNS name like ABC43213524273, big long glop, and randomly generate it every time. The chances of that being a real domain are almost zero. So close to zero, it doesn't matter.
Okay.
A really dumb, naive way to do it would be to pick one non-existent domain name and hard code it into your malware. And that's what this malware was doing. That's what WannaCry was doing.
Oh.
And by registering that domain, it made the malware think it was always in a lab.
Oh.
And hide. It wasn't a kill switch. It was a hide me. It was a, oh, I will hide switch. It was put me into stealth mode switch, which has the effect of it not running around encrypting files because it's hiding.
That is, okay, so that, I knew there was something about the domain name, but I could never quite get the subtlety of that. That's why, that's really, really interesting.
Yes. And we also said at the time, this kill switch is not going to last long. And that is exactly true, because within hours of the domain being registered, there were new variants of WannaCry that did not have the code in it to go to sleep if that domain name existed.
And yet, there hasn't been massive infections, have there?
No, the infection since numbers are still pretty high, actually. There hasn't been
new infections.
Payout. There hasn't been, well, the whole world did kind of respond pretty quickly, and new infections have continued. What people are saying is that not as much ransom has been paid as people would expect, given how much chaos was caused on planet Earth. People are saying, I mean, this didn't raise very much. You know, I think the last number I saw was $70,000. And I'm thinking to myself, this probably took someone 2 days' work to write this malware, and they've just made $70,000. So I don't think the ROI is quite so bad. I think people feel terrible because, well, planet Earth suffered massively, and the guys at least should have made a few million for all of this suffering. But that's kind of not how the world works, because basically almost no one is paying the ransom on this one, because it's all over the media, and it just, I don't think people are falling for it in terms of paying. I think people are just going, oh, well.
Well, but I mean, but we had hospitals offline. I mean, did every hospital then patch all of the systems or fix their network so that it couldn't get in? Or I don't understand, because I haven't heard of it continuing to spread.
Okay, well, first off, every AV was picking it up straight away after that. And secondly, every perimeter firewall on the planet probably got a rule added against those Windows ports that were allowing it to be reached in from the outside through that Shadow Broker's vulnerability. So, I mean, it made such a media splash. Yeah, of course, you know, of course it got dented. That's sort of my take on it. I mean, people around the world were patching like mad.
Okay. So I haven't read the notes to see whether you're going to talk about this, but can you explain the port? Because it sounds like it's an SMB port, a Samba port?
Okay, yes. Okay, so this malware doesn't want to be classified. This if you try to pigeonhole this malware, it will not fit. You will have to smash down the walls between your pigeonholes.
Okay.
So this thing didn't spread in one way. This thing spread in many ways. This was a tool of this used many different alternatives. So one of the ways it spread was to use a vulnerability in the SMB protocol. So not Samba as in the open source Linux project, SMB as in the protocol by Microsoft.
Oh, I thought it was Windows. Okay.
Right. So it's the SMB protocol, not Samba. And they're just two different things. So Samba is an open source implementation of SMB. SMB is part of Windows. It's just simple messaging block, I think, is SMB. So the SMB protocol had some really nasty bugs in it, which Microsoft patched in March.
Mm-hmm.
If your machine wasn't patched in March, then you could send packets at the SMB process in Windows, which is on a few different ports, one of which is 445, and I can't remember the other ones off the top of my head. And then that would cause remote code execution, and therefore you have a way into the machine. So the Shadow Brokers released sample code for how to use this exploit. And that sample code was included in WannaCry. So one of the ways WannaCry spread itself was by using this known vulnerability in SMB in unpatched instances of Windows.
Okay.
But apparently it also spread itself through traditional phishing, just getting people to run it.
But why would somebody have SMB open as a port on a... Why would that be open?
Planet Earth has idiots on it.
But I mean, millions and millions, millions and millions of them. Not
okay. So
there must be a reason.
Was this malware
that
actively scanned? Right. So a lot of you can scan the internet today, and you will find. We reported here on this very show. You will find hundreds of thousands of open SMB ports. So there are people stupid enough on planet Earth to have open SMB ports.
Is there a reason to open it?
No, it's just failure to close. It's just inaction rather than action.
But I thought ports are closed unless you open them.
No, if you don't have, if you're on a home internet with a NAT router, you have by a pure accident of NAT, a one-way valve on your network. If you have a modem that doesn't do NAT, if you have a traditional DSL internet connection without just one computer, one modem, straight out, no NAT, then everything's open by default.
Okay, but really? Hospitals had really? Thing had
no, okay, right.
So, mission critical machines
this
not on.
Let me, yeah, no, okay. So perimeter firewalls, there are machines on planet Earth. We know from a scan that was done shortly after Shadow Brokers released the exploit. Security researchers went out and checked how many actual ports are there open on planet Earth, and the answer was a few tens of thousands. But there is also a subtle difference. So at this stage, someone like a hospital, their perimeter firewall will be blocking these ports. Like 99.99% sure these hospitals were blocking these ports on the perimeter.
Okay, good.
But because the malware was spreading in multiple ways, including phishing, if they got in behind the perimeter firewall, then it was reaching out inside the window, inside the network, looking for Windows PCs that hadn't been patched. And inside your LAN, of course you have Windows file sharing turned on.
Right.
Which is done with SMB.
Right, but my understanding was the way they got into the networks was through port 445.
That's one of the potential vectors. That's what I'm saying. This malware doesn't categorize well. One of the ways in was by looking for publicly accessible port 445. But that's not how most of it spread, because you're right. You're not going to get inside a hospital by looking at a public port 445. Maybe someone took home a laptop, got infected, and then brought an infected machine in. Maybe someone double-clicked on a spam email.
I was hearing that that's not how it got in, that it didn't get in through phishing, that it got in through port 445. And I just, that's the part I didn't understand.
The port 445 is the bit that makes it a worm. So the reason you can put this into the worm pigeonhole is because it does do wormy behavior, and it does that wormy behavior in port 445, but it also behaves in lots of other ways too. This is a jack-of-all-trades malware. This malware spread in many ways. And once it goes in, it tried all sorts of things to spread itself.
By the way, I did an open search on why would you open up the SMB port. And I could be really snotty and post this. It's an article from Microsoft saying SMB file and printer sharing ports should be open. Here's why you should open them. Port 445.
The context is
you won't be able to share printers.
Right, but within your LAN, they should be open. To the internet, they shouldn't.
They specifically refer to firewalls, but I think that's like...
On a PC or on a perimeter of a corporation?
You know, they don't give a context. I think it's Windows firewall locally on a machine is what they're talking about. But if I crop this perfectly, it looks really idiotic.
Right.
Okay.
And actually, another thing, because there are so many bad things that happen over port 445 over the years, a lot of ISPs who serve home users rather than corporate users will block 445 at the perimeter of the ISP.
Oh, okay.
It's just such a known problem, port 445. Because there was a time when by default there was no Windows firewall, and there's a hidden share on many versions of Windows called $C, which is your C drive. And so before ISP started blocking 445, some people would just turn on their Windows computer and have their C drive shared out to the world without a username or password. So that's why a lot of ISPs have that kind of a block. Anyway, one of the phrases that sticks in my mind from all of my reading on this, the exact details are still hazy, I believe the words used by Kaspersky, and they were describing two things, exactly how the malware spreads and exactly which versions of Windows are exactly how susceptible. So the other big brouhaha is whether or not XP really was as much of a problem as people are saying. And the first thing I'll say is the focus on XP is wrong. If there hadn't been a single XP machine on planet Earth, this still would have been a huge problem.
Yeah, that was fascinating that it was really more Windows 7 than anything else.
It was unpatched PCs. It just seems that Windows 7 is most common within the enterprise. The enterprise is most slow about applying patches, and therefore most infections are Windows 7, is my reading of it.
Okay.
So basically, Windows 7 is what's in the corporate environment. The corporate environment is where updates are held back for policy reasons rather than just put out straight away. Most home users just update. Or their PC reboots itself.
Wait. We don't know that.
Well, certainly on Windows 10, if you're a home user of Windows 10, your PC will reboot itself.
That would assume that you've already gone to Windows 10. And I don't think that's the case.
Okay, but if you bought a new computer, you haven't chosen an operating system. Windows 7 hasn't been shipped on new home PCs for years now.
Nah, but for a long time after Windows 8 came out, they would allow you to buy it with Windows 7 for a long time.
Right, but your average home user just goes out and buys whatever's on the machine. So if you look at the balance of OSs, if you walk into a house and pick a random PC, it's less likely to be Windows 7 than if you walk into a corporation and pick a random PC. Because corporations are actively holding PCs back on Windows 7.
I agree that in the corporate market, companies do hold back, but I don't...
Well, I'm talking generalizations here, right? I am making sweeping generalizations. These are averages, not... If finding an exception to what I'm saying is
No. I'm not trying to find an exception. I believe, and I'll try to find stats to prove whether I'm right or not, is that the market share of Windows 7 in home users is significantly bigger than Windows 10. That's what I believe, but I have no facts as of this point to support my belief.
I would be surprised by that just because most people don't make a decision about their OS.
But people aren't buying new PCs. That's the fallacy, is people aren't actually buying...
Hang on, but Windows 7 is sodding well ancient.
Yes, and people love it.
Okay, but no, but I'm saying most home users don't have an opinion. They just walk into a shop and they walk out with a PC that costs as little money as possible. And it's
okay, well,
Windows
I can...
8, Windows 8.1, or Windows 10 for quite some time now.
So Windows 7, according to net market share, is only 48.5% of the market right now. That's including businesses and home users.
Exactly. And in business, it's very strong. So a good chunk of that half of the planet is in business.
Yeah.
Education and hospitals is in places with an IT department.
Yeah. Well, we will leave you as right until I can prove otherwise.
Well, anyway, the key point, though, right? The key point is a lot of people focused on Windows XP as if, well, none of this would have happened if Windows XP had actually been gone.
Like, yeah.
No.
Yeah.
Now, the exact numbers, there's no exact numbers on this that are in agreement. So Kaspersky say 97% of PCs that are affected with this malware were running on Windows 7. That doesn't sniff right to me. And BitSight, who are another security company, they say, yeah, it is mostly Windows 7, but not 97%. 67% of Windows 7 share. And that seems more believable to me. But either way, if the takeaway you've taken from this is, oh, well, if only Windows XP was gone, this wouldn't have happened, you've completely, totally, and utterly missed the point.
Yeah.
The point is, when Microsoft patch, apply the sodding patch. If your OS doesn't get patches anymore, you have a problem. That's the takeaway. Not Windows XP this or Windows 7 that. No. Patch, 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 patch. That's what you should be focusing on.
Bart, you should have told us that a while ago.
If only someone had thought to say that. The other thing, by the way, which is related, and now seems like the perfect time to throw it in, we have been speculating for some time that there was something a bit unusual about the March patch from Microsoft, that its timing was suspicious, as if Microsoft knew something we didn't. We now know Microsoft knew something we didn't, because it has been reported by reputable journalists that the NSA were so worried. Basically, the NSA knew that Shadow Brokers had stolen stuff, and they knew what Shadow Brokers had stolen before Shadow Brokers were able to leak it. And in that interim, they went to Microsoft and went, there is some bad stuff about to go down. Here's what you need to patch.
Well, I guess good on them.
Update was. It is good on them, and it's what we all suspected but couldn't prove. Our suspicions were correct. And I just thought we'd mention that.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things I've enjoyed on a lot of different shows has been a discussion of a couple of things, and I don't want us to get into this, but it's been interesting hearing the different views, because I don't have my own strong opinion either way. But should the NSA hold on to these bugs when they find them? Do we want the NSA, you know, the other side of the coin is, do you want the NSA trying to stop North Korea and do things to them to make them not be able to achieve some of their goals? You know, it's a really good dilemma and a good discussion to be having. And I've heard a lot of shows having conversations about it. And it was Walt Mossberg was talking about on Control, Walt, Delete, and his perspective was very surprising. It's just interesting dialogue about it.
Well, I think the answer is both. I think basically you can. I don't think you can make an absolute rule. I think you have to make a value judgment, and what you hope is that there's some sort of process involved where someone who knows their stuff is evaluating each bug and deciding what is the potential advantage of keeping it secret, and what are the potential dangers of not telling Microsoft or Apple or whoever.
One of the discussions, somebody said, okay, what we need them to do is, if the bug you found could destroy the world and you don't actually need that one to get these particular bad guys, then let us have it. But if you can find a narrow one that only affects North Korea, then you could keep that one. Okay.
Yeah, I mean, that's kind of what it comes down to. But now, it's interesting you say this, because there is some actual news to report in that direction. So Microsoft came out extremely strongly. Their president and chief legal officer, which is an interesting combination. Not very many companies have a president and chief legal officer, but anyway, Microsoft do. He wrote a fairly scathing, I think it was a blog post on Microsoft's site, basically decrying the government for hoarding these kind of exploits and repeating Microsoft's call for what they are, their marketing team, I guess, is calling a digital Geneva Convention. So like we outlaw the use of biological weapons and things like that, we should outlaw the hoarding of these kind of vulnerabilities, is Microsoft's take. So that is part of that same conversation that's going on all over the planet, where people are kind of going, should they, shouldn't they? And my answer is, it depends.
Right.
It's every shade of gray to me. I love being able to have a strong opinion on stuff and express my strong opinion and say, well, no, clearly you should do X, but I'll be damned if there's a clearly in this case.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's what makes the dialogue be so interesting around this one. Yeah. All right.
There is some evidence linking WannaCry to something called the Lazarus Group, which is a hacking group that has been linked to North Korea. And you may have heard of them before. They did Sony Pictures.
Oh, and they did that right around the time that Sony put out that movie about killing the president, right?
Yeah. Kim Jong, can't remember which Kim it was at the time. But was it Un at the time or
I
Il?
Think we're Il
or
now.
I they're all very similar.
Yeah.
Well, they are literally all related. another interesting thing is that at the time the Shadow Brokers exploits were released, we all expected there to be lots of malware making use of it. And WannaCry has certainly stolen the news. But WannaCry is not the only malware making use of the vulnerabilities published by the Shadow Brokers. And in their work examining WannaCry, security researchers actually found an older botnet that used the same mechanism to spread, which had 200,000 computers in it, but it wasn't ransomware. It was hijacking people's CPUs to mine bitcoins, and so it was doing its absolute best to hide.
Oh.
And it succeeded in doing so for probably the best part of a month. They think it may date back as far as the 24th of April.
Oh, wow. And they just happened to find it because they were scanning for this.
So as part of their work in investigating WannaCry, they stumbled onto this botnet of 200,000 PCs that was gathered in the same way. So that's
wow. That probably made a lot more money than the ransomware people did.
Almost certainly, yes. To be honest, yes, because 200,000 PCs cranking out bitcoins for you, Bitcoin has reached a record high in terms of exchange rate with the dollar. So yes, actually, good timing on their part. That's kind of all of the things I wanted to talk about. There is many links in the show notes covering, and I weeded these down a bit, so this isn't everything I read up on the topic, but these are sort of a good smattering of the coverage of what we've just talked about.
Wow, so, there's only like 14. Good job.
Yes.
All right,
we have
what's
one
next?
Security medium. We have one security medium, but it's not actually too big. It's just potentially very confusing. So I thought we should break it out.
Okay.
So when I say to you iCloud, what do you think of?
How my photos go up to the cloud.
Right. In this case, when I say iCloud, I want you to think much, much, much more narrowly. I want you to basically think only the groupware features, mail, contacts, and calendars. So when we say that third-party iCloud apps are going to need app-specific passwords from the 15th of June, I do not mean apps from the various app stores that use the iCloud APIs to do cool things.
So you I don't mean how Together from Reinvented Software syncs your data between your devices with iCloud.
Bingo, because they're using CloudKit, which is Apple's API, and so they're doing everything securely and properly anyway.
Okay.
What I mean is third-party apps, apps not made by Apple, into which you enter your iCloud username and password.
So SparkMail.
Precisely. Thunderbird.
From Riedel. Okay.
Exchange, those kind of things.
All right.
Those kind of apps are going to stop working until you create an app-specific password.
Huh.
And the reason for this is because right now, your iCloud password, if you give an app your iCloud password, you're not giving it access to just email. You're giving it access to everything in your iCloud. And that has become a very large set of things.
Hmm.
So if you do an app-specific password that's only going to work for the more traditional protocols like IMAP, SMTP, POP3, CalDAV. And so that's actually a much better thing. So basically what you're going to do is allow those apps to continue to do the groupware stuff by the third party, but they're not going to be able to log into your iCloud.com. I mean, right now you're trusting Sparkle or whatever you just said there as your example app, or you're trusting Thunderbird, say, with absolutely everything you do in iCloud. And that's not what you want. You want your mail client to have access to your mail.
Okay, so if I tell Spark my username and password, they now have the username and password to my photos.
Yes.
To my credit card in iTunes.
Yes. Yes.
Wow. Yeah, they should fix that.
Right.
Why has that not been scary before? Why did they just realize that now?
I think it's because iCloud, there hasn't been a moment in time where iCloud went from only, I mean, historically iCloud really only was a sort of a competitor to Google Apps or whatever. Mm-hmm. Now it's just doing so much. But there was no one moment in time when it went from being just that to being more than just that. So I think it's one of those, if you boil the frog slowly enough.
He doesn't
know. Someone obviously went, you know something? I think this water's getting awfully close to boiling. So the big point is on June 15th, you're going to need to start using app-specific passwords. This is a very good thing from a security point of view. It's a small amount of effort on your part once. So basically, at the moment when you configure these third-party apps, you will have to generate the app-specific password, pop it into the app, and then the app will work just fine.
Okay,
and
talk about how that – describe app. How that happens.
I'm not going to. I'm going to. In the show notes, there's a link to iMore, who've done it way better than I have.
Okay. I get really confused on the words app-specific passwords, because that's what I what 1Password calls the six-digit code that gets generated when I do the two-factor authentication.
No, they're time-based codes.
That's not the words that they use. They are time-based codes. You're right. Let me bring it up here and double-check to make sure.
Use the word app-specific password.
It's something close to that. Maybe it's not exactly that. Let me find one. I know
if
I've got one.
Exactly that. I think my head would have exploded by now.
Okay,
unless
so
I just don't read well enough.
Let me edit here. What do they call it? There's a name for it. Okay, and my trackpad stopped working? Why can't go to edit? What do they call this? Let me hover over it. Ah, I'm gonna have to. Let me just do a new log. Just do something that doesn't have it. Edit. It was something close to that. So if I tap that thing, one-time password is what they call it.
Yes, that's not the same as app specific.
Okay, yeah, it's a specific app. It's a specific one-time app. So they're not one-time app, passwords. They're app specific passwords. But can you give us the general gist?
Okay, so you log into your iCloud.com. And you say, I want to create an app-specific password. They'll ask you to give it some sort of label so that you can recognize it in your control panel later to revoke access at any time. and it will then auto-generate for you a big, long, random pile of glop. In other words, a very secure password. It will be a huge, big pile of random garbage. That random garbage will work as a password on your account for only the Google Apps style stuff. And you will then copy and paste that into your mail client or your calendar client. And it will use your normal username and that password. And that username password combination will only get them into the mail and calendar stuff, and it will not let them into real iCloud.
Okay.
And you can revoke it at any time by going to your control panel. You'll recognize it because you gave it a label, and you can say revoke, and then that app-specific password will stop working. So it's like having a sub-password. It's like having a second password on your account, but that second password has fewer rights.
But it's going to generate it for me. I don't get to pick it, so I don't get to make a BART-type password, and I don't get to put it in one password.
No, it's better than that. It's picking a truly, fully random. You are never going to type this in anywhere. You're going to copy and paste it once, exactly once. You don't have to remember it. If you forget it, just recreate another one. Delete the current app-specific password, create a new one, and copy and paste that into your devices. So Apple, it's like a random, it's like a key. Think of it as a cryptographic key. So it's 100 and something bits of absolute pure random garbage, which is great.
I guess I would be less annoyed if it were ever true that you only have to do this stuff once. I have to enter my two-factor authentication all the freaking time, and they always say, oh, trust this browser? Yes. Trust it tomorrow? Yes. Still trust? Yeah. Trust it? Yes. So I don't know. I don't know if I believe this. We'll see.
Well, I would say don't use third-party apps for your iCloud stuff, but that's a whole...
No. I'm talking about I go to iCloud.com.
Okay, 2FA is not the same thing. Let's not confuse things even more. We've already said that one password used too confusing a word. It's nothing to do... It's not two-factor auth. It's app-specific passwords.
Okay, but that's another thing that they said I'd only have to do once. So that's why I'm just complaining. I hate everything right now.
Okay. Anyway, the point is...
Oh, wait. No, it is conflated. I'm going to make sure I mess you up. The iMore link that you sent does have the instructions on how to do this. It says under the security section, select generate passwords. If you don't see the option, you'll need to enable two-factor authentication, which is different than two-step verification. Sorry.
Yes, you're right. That is a small subtlety that if you're going to use third-party apps, you have to have two-factor auth enabled on your iCloud account.
Okay.
Again, this only is for the groupware-style apps. This is not for stuff you buy in the App Store. This is not for the sort of the normal run-of-the-mill iCloud stuff. This is for people who access their iCloud through a third-party app.
Okay.
Which is, I don't know how popular a thing that is to do.
Oh, and we'll find Spark out. Is really, really popular. Everybody's been telling me I got to use Spark. Unfortunately, I can't get it to do what I want it to do, but people love it.
Fair enough. Okay, I just use Mail.app. I think I like Mail.app. Anyway, that's another here and there. There are instructions in the show notes from the good people at iMore, which will help you set up app-specific passwords on your iPhone, your iPad, or your Mac. So wherever you happen to be physically at the point in time you wish to set this up, these instructions from iMore will let you get there from any of those devices.
Do you have to... So if you set it up using your phone, does that mean that your iPad and your Mac are okay? Do you have to do it on all of them?
It entirely depends on how many clients you have, whether you're going to pop that app-specific password into one password so you can easily copy and paste it between machines.
But you would have to do it on all your... But you'd have to do it on all your devices.
Right, yes. So anywhere where you need to log into your iCloud through a third-party app, like you will be configuring Sparkle or whatever it's called.
Spark.
Spark. At the point in time you're configuring Spark, you have to enter this app-specific password instead of your real password. That's it, right?
Okay.
How you make that happen is entirely up to you. The fact is you have to use it. You have to use this generated password, not your real password, for Spark or for Thunderbird.
Oh, so you never use your real one?
Bingo. Yes,
oh.
That's the whole point of this. The whole point is that Spark never ever see your real one. That is the problem to be solved.
Okay. It never does it in the first place. That's interesting. And they all promise to erase it, do they?
No. You can go in and revoke the password yourself. So you
in
have
third-party apps?
Yes. So you have created this special password that's not your real password that you're going to have to use for these third-party apps. You can go into your iCloud and say, no longer trust that password.
No, but I mean, if I've already given rattle.
Oh, no, look. Yeah, no, you don't have a time machine, sorry.
Yeah, okay.
From June 15th onwards, you will never be giving your real password to a third-party app again.
That does sound really cool. I would like to the record to note that I will have to enter it five times, not once, just for...
Okay.
But once on every device.
There was a time when I used app-specific passwords for a third-party client. I don't bother with third-party clients anymore, but I did it for a while, and I simply added in one password, you can add as many fields as you like, and you can mark them as extra password fields. So I just added an extra password field and labeled it as the name of the app.
Okay, so you do put them in there.
I do, because like you, I'm not a one-device kind of person.
Yeah, so you put it in to which
into
entry?
iCloud. So basically iCloud has an entry which has my real username and my real password, and then I would click edit and I click plus to add another field. I say this is also a password field. I give it the label name of the app, and then I paste in
That's a good idea.
And if you said it's typed to be password, it'll be starred out and it'll behave just like any other password, but it will be labeled as Spark or Thunderbird or Outlook or Fantastical or third-party mail contact calendar app you're using.
Okay.
Okay, cool. So there we go. That is a change coming on June 15th that is important we flag. And I couldn't possibly do that as a single bullet point in important security news.
No. I'm really glad we took the time to go through that.
Cool. So now we can flip into more normal mode. Important security updates. The short version is Apple have updated everything. They're all security updates, so apply them.
Oh, should we do that? Notes.
Yeah, apparently it's a good idea.
It's a thing.
WordPress have released a critical security update that could allow a remote attacker to take over unupdated sites. And Joomla have released a critical security update that fixes a bug that could allow remote attackers to take over a site. So basically, the two of the most common CMSs both had an important update in the last 2 weeks. So if you run a website with either, do please make sure you're up to date.
I will.
Now, just to really confuse you, the Samba project, as in the open source implementation of SMB, they have also released a security update, which does indeed affect Linux servers pretending to be Windows file servers, and it would allow remote code execution on that Linux file server, which you could, in theory, write a worm to exploit, so you could, in theory, tweak the current ransomware attack so that it will also attack Linux servers. Therefore, if you run a Linux desktop, which has Windows file sharing enabled through Samba, or a Linux server, which is acting as a Windows file server, you need to patch your version of Samba. The update is out there, so it's easy to do. Yum update, apt-get update, whatever it is for your particular version of Linux.
I have some Linux servers. Do I have to worry about that? My web servers?
No, your web servers are not running Windows file sharing.
Or even pretending. Okay, good.
Yeah. At least, well, they should. No, they're not. I happen to know they're not. A number of popular media players, including VLC and Popcorn Time, have released updates to fix a critical bug in the parsing of subtitle files, which would make it possible for someone to use a malicious subtitle file to run arbitrary code on your computer. This is obviously not a good thing.
Oh.
Yeah, I mean, anything that you parse has the potential to cause trouble, right? So we've had them in JPEGs, now we have them in subtitles. So the good news is that VLC, Popcorn Time, and a few other common apps have updates.
Wow.
The bad news is the security researchers are pretty sure the same code with the same mistake exists elsewhere, but hasn't been patched yet. So maybe if you're using a media player other than VLC or Popcorn Time, maybe don't just accept subtitle files unthinkingly. Maybe now is not a good time to just randomly grab those from the internet.
Wow. Yeah. Huh.
Important security news. In the midst of everything else that's going on, it made almost zero news. But President Trump issued an executive order covering cybersecurity, the Cybersecurity Executive Order. And actually, it was really well received by the security community. Basically, it's utterly boring, completely unsexy in any way, shape, or form. It is basically continuation, the logical next steps in a program begun by President Obama. Basically, the bureaucrats got their way, and it is sane, sensible, boring improvements to policy. Brilliant.
Okay. And they are, oh, I remember those. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. So it's really boring stuff. Basically, within government, it's just tightening up the way IT is managed within the massive big government bureaucracy. And it was triggered in the wake of the massive OPM breach. That was sort of the straw that broke the camel's back. And as the Ars Technica story covers it pretty well, but it's basically the boring, plodding, uninteresting stuff that's really bloody important.
Okay, good.
Twitter have updated their privacy policy. So this is a good news, bad news story. So the bad news is they have made it clear that they are going to cease honoring the do not track flag. So DNT is, I would say you can now safely say that DNT is a failed attempt at the industry self-regulating itself. So the theory was a compromise had been hammered out between browser makers and companies who rely on advertising. And the deal offered was this. If browser makers default this flag, it's just literally a header in the HTTP request called DNT, do not track. If browsers defaulted the header to off unless the user explicitly turned it on, then advertisers would respect the flag and not track any request that had the flag set.
Okay.
It's an interesting compromise.
Was that set by the browser companies or by the human?
Okay, so the compromise hammered out was that the browser manufacturers agreed they would not have the flag ticked unless a human agreed to it. And in exchange for the fact that this then made the flag very explicitly an actual user preference and not a default,
okay,
then the advertising industry agreed they would honor it.
Okay.
And then Microsoft said, yeah, saw that. Everyone wants not to be tracked. Therefore, in Edge, we are going to turn that flag on whether the user explicitly asked to or not. The advertising industry went, well, then the deal's off. And pretty much everyone has ignored it since. And Twitter were one of the few companies who were still abiding by it. And they have now said, yeah, enough is enough. This is a failed enterprise. Basically, Microsoft shot it and now it's fully dead.
Hmm. Okay.
It was a compromise. It was only going to work if both sides gave give and take. That's not how it worked out.
Okay.
So now I think the only possibility is some sort of government regulation, which is... I would have been much nicer if this had worked. But anyway, so Twitter have sort of bowed to the inevitable and realized that this thing is meaningless. So that's the bad news part. The good news part is that Twitter have added more knobs and buttons for you to twiddle on so that you have more control over what they do and don't save. And they've added some transparency where they show you what they know about you so that you can go in and have a little poke around and see how icked out you are. And that may or may not influence your twiddling of the various knobs and buttons they have given you.
Okay.
So that is what it is. Elcomsoft, who have made news before by discovering a bug that meant that browser history was hanging around in iCloud longer than it should, have continued to poke around inside iCloud, and they have now discovered that notes hang around longer than they should. Now, I need to be clear here. No one is saying there's anything malicious or in any way underhanded going on here, and there is no information leaking in any way. So if you have your iCloud username and password and you use that iCloud username and password to poke around inside your own iCloud account, then it is possible to find notes that should be deleted.
It should have been deleted by Apple within the 30 yes. days they say they were going to do?
Well, no. So the Apple's... A feature of notes is that all of your notes are kept for at least 30 days so that you can restore them if you want to.
At least or up to?
At least.
Okay.
So it's a 30-day recovery window is what is the feature offered.
Right.
So the user-facing feature is for 30 days you can get your notes back. Now, the implied corollary to that is that after 30 days they will definitely be deleted. But that's not quite... It doesn't seem that always happens. They vanish from the list, but there seems to be a few remnants of them left hanging around in the database.
Well, if they say at least 30 days, then that's fits in with
what
they
mean.
Said.
Exactly. So, but they do disappear off the list. So it looks like there's a bug in the code that's partially deleting the notes, but not fully deleting them.
Hmm. Okay.
So basically, this is a bug on the back end of iCloud, which Apple are almost certain to fix. And it's not leaking any of your data to anyone else. It's just that it conceivably could be clogging up your iCloud a little bit. Now, this notes are text, so I don't think it's clogging up your iCloud a lot. But when something is deleted, it should be fully deleted. So Apple should fix it. But it's not a set your hair on fire, this is a catastrophe. It's just some bugginess on the back end of iCloud that Apple need to fix.
Okay.
If that makes sense. In case anyone still had any sort of faith whatsoever in Yahoo, we have now discovered that there was a period of time which spanned multiple years during which Yahoo continued to use versions of open source libraries with known vulnerabilities, which allowed attackers to scoop random pieces of memory from Yahoo's servers, which is very much like the Heartbleed vulnerability, but it was through a different mechanism. So security researchers who are reporting on this fact, so it has been patched now, but it was the case for 20-something months, if memory serves, that they were leaking out memory from their servers. So basically, during the time frame when we now know that all of our passwords had been leaked, or millions of them or billions of them, I can't even remember whether it's millions or billions anymore, during that same period of time, they were also leaking RAM. And so it's been nicknamed Yahoo Bleed. But really, at this stage, I think everyone assumes that everything on the Yahoo account has been compromised 20 ways since Sunday. So now it's 21 ways. Would be a major story if Yahoo hadn't already messed up so many times.
Yeah, I mean, it's just like, okay.
It was leaked yet another way.
Right, right.
1Password have introduced an interesting feature for people who sign up on their cloud-based accounts. So you can sign up with a family account or a Teams account, and it's sort of software as a service version of 1Password as opposed to the standalone one. And they have now created something called Travel Mode, which allows you, so if you have a 1Password account, you can have multiple separate password vaults which can be shared with multiple people. And there is now the possibility of putting a sort of a tick or a tag or a label on a specific vault, which says whether or not it's considered safe for travelers. So you can basically mark a vault and say, this one I consider safe while I'm traveling, this one I consider sensitive while I'm traveling. And so you just mark your different vaults to say which they are. And if you're in a team, if you're doing it in a corporate setting through Teams, it's actually your administrator of the corporate account who controls this rather than you, the end user. If you're in a family account, it's you, the end user, controls this. And then there's a button within the iCloud app where you just basically say, I am now traveling. Sorry, not the iCloud app, the 1Password app. You just basically say, I am now traveling. And the app will delete from your device completely all the vaults not marked as being safe to travel.
That
so even if you're
so
forced to unlock your app, they're gone.
That's fantastic.
And then you have to, when you come back, reconnect to the web interface and say, push the travel vaults or the not safe for travel vaults back down to the iPhone.
Oh, so you can't do it within the app.
You can't do it in the app because otherwise you could be made do it at the border.
Right, right. What about this? What about, it sounds like this would also work, is I go through U.S. Border Patrol, because let's be honest, that's who we're talking about. I go across the border and then I can just turn it on when I'm in the other country.
Yes, you can.
And then turn it and then go back to the travel only one as I go across the border and then turn it back on.
Correct. Absolutely.
Because I thought this sounded like a really cool idea when I heard about it. But the one problem with it was that I tried to think, okay, what passwords would I not want that are not need that are yet critical to me? You know what I mean?
It depends on the setting, right? So if you're in a corporate environment, this is actually even more useful. Because in a corporate environment, I have my passwords. So your corporate Teams environment, basically everyone gets their own personal vault within the Teams environment. And then there's vaults that are sort of team specific, task specific. So you could hypothetically have a vault that contains all the private keys for all of your SSL certs. Mm-hmm. And you might have a vault that contains all the passwords related to data center number one, and a vault that contains all the passwords related to data center number two. Well, when you're traveling, you don't need access to the private keys for your SSL certs.
Why not?
Well, because you would only need those if you were installing a whole brand new server, which is not something you're going to do while you're at a meeting in San Francisco. Like, that's the kind of information you need once every 2 or 3 years.
That's the thing. You get into subtleties there. You do need your logons of those servers in case something goes wrong back at home on the trip.
But I'm saying there are types of things which you don't need regularly. Private keys to SSL certs they're not needed to log into anything. You need them probably never.
Okay. Okay. Right? But let's talk regular humans using 1Password. So I care deeply about if something goes wrong to my Puffy.com server. I want to have that access to that when I'm on travel.
Okay. Then you would choose to put that in the travel safe vault.
What would be something I wouldn't want? And that I wouldn't want the government to see as I cross the border, and I would not care about when I'm on travel. I think that's a null set for me, at least. I mean, I don't want them looking at my Facebook.
It is for you. Me personally, I wouldn't care about anything to do with anything to do with any of the hats I didn't have with me as I was traveling. I basically want the ability to get to my email and maybe my Twitter, and I really wouldn't care about anything else. I want it all locked away.
Yeah, I'm trying to think of the examples for a regular human. One of the problems is they're now saying they can get into your Facebook account, for example, or your Twitter account, and they want to go in and fish around and be you. Well, those are the very things a regular human would want to use when on vacation or on business travel. You would want to be able to go fool around in those social media accounts, very things that you don't want them to see.
Okay, but thanks to the magic of OAuth, that's actually not a problem because your client is authenticated with an OAuth key, not with your username and password. So you can leave the Twitter app on iOS logged in, and then, yeah, they can have a poke around, but you can still post, but they never get your username and password, so they can only do what you're watching them do. So you could remove the password from your vault and still post, still tweet.
Hmm. Yeah, I don't know. It doesn't seem like it has as much... It's a cool idea, and I like that it exists, but I don't know that it has a lot of value for the regular person.
Well, I think it allows people to make a decision without having hassle. So the reason this feature came about was because a corporation published a guide for how to use 1Password, and they had people manually do this. So manually create a separate vault, manually copy over the keys, manually delete all the vaults apart from that vault, cross the border and then manually re-download the vault. Yeah. And what the 1Password guys did was they automated this process and made it a feature.
I'd have to think through it more. I don't want to poo-poo it because I do think it's a great idea. I just tried to think how I would ever use it and I couldn't quite see it. I do think the idea of, there was a NASA guy, a JPL guy? Who was it? No, there was a government guy who was crossing the border into the United States and was forced to reveal his passwords or to let them into some systems.
Yeah.
And had he had 1Password where he, flipped that switch, crossed the border and then switched it back, he wouldn't have had it compromised.
Exactly. And I think it's great that they've given it to 1Password family accounts because it means that people who care about this kind of stuff and want to use a feature can. But I actually think the real value is in the 1Password for Teams because the 1Password for Teams is controlled by the system administrators.
Yeah.
Who are exactly the people who should be making these kind of decisions about what's happening with corporate-owned passwords.
Yep.
So, I think it's nice that we get it as regular plebs, but the real the real feature is that it's in the corporate product.
Yep.
Another piece of good news, there are many types of ransomware, but one of the families of ransomware that's out there making people's lives miserable is called Crysis, and cry is spelled as in with tears. So C-R-Y-S-I-S. Yeah, I like the puns sometimes in these things. Anyway, someone, and it is completely unknown who, because Pastebin is anonymous, but someone has placed the master unlock key for that ransomware on Pastebin. So the cat is out of the bag.
And you mean, so if someone gets compromised with the ransomware, this would unlock it? Their data?
Correct. It also means that everyone who has been crisised in the past and who has decided to hold on to the locked files can now unlock the files. So this is something, actually, this is a good opportunity to say, if you get ransomware, even if you have backups to get you back 80% of your stuff or 90% of your stuff, it's worth holding on to the ones the encrypted data, because a lot of the time the keys leak eventually. And so, you may not get your data back straight away, but you might get it in 6 months or a year.
Hmm.
So, it's worth holding on to, even if it's impossible to decrypt at the moment, because sometimes you're gambling. It's not a guarantee, but it has happened a few times now where these keys have been leaked.
I think most people would keep the data around. You know, I'm still keeping one earring that I really like, the set of earrings, and I'm sure I'm going to find that other one someday. It's been like 12 years. I think it's going to show up any minute now.
Well, I like the optimism.
Yeah. However ill-founded.
Indeed. Now, the next story here is, I find difficult to know what to say about it, other than the fact that I find it deeply, deeply icky. So Google have their next conference, and we as techie people like to think about the bit of it where they tell us all the cool stuff they're doing for their various software and hardware platforms. And that's what we think of next. But there's also another conference for the marketing and advertising people, because the real customers of Google are people who buy ads. So there's Marketing Next is a conference run by Google. And Google used that conference to announce a new product called Google Attribution. And its raison d'etre is to prove to people who buy ads that those ads work. And what they promise the advertisers is that they can tell that Google know when you buy things in the physical world and can correlate that with the advertisements they have shown you. And one of the inputs to this that we know about is that Google have managed to get access through various partners to 70% of the credit card transactions that occur in the United States of America. So Google are correlating your credit card bills with your activities on Google accounts. And they are using that to tell advertisers how brilliant they are.
How did they get access to credit card transaction data?
By paying companies who broker these kind of things to get
that data. Is brokerable?
Well, it's processed by people, right? The banking industry has all of that information. The banking industry has all
I know, but they're allowed to sell that? That Allison?
They're allowed to sell digested versions. Google insists that all of this is anonymous, but they can still tie it back to specific ads they've shown at specific times, so it can't be that anonymous.
Well, and you said what you bought.
Yeah.
So that's not, yes. That's even, you're saying that's a level deeper. So that's,
oh, yeah. I mean, the point is, ad shown to Google person with ID 42745, purchase made by Google person, by person with Google ID 7245, correlate the two.
I'm trying to picture. So 95% of my credit card transactions say Amazon.
Yeah, look.
Right, you can prove I bought here, something on Amazon, but okay. You can't prove what I bought.
Okay, right. So this is the thing. Google are promising the people they're selling ads to that they can do this, and therefore they can get more money out of people buying ads. And obviously it's in Google's interest to big up their ability. So the audience they're talking to incentivizes Google to overstate their capability.
Sure. Okay.
The big thing is that Google are also saying, oh yeah, and don't worry, we're doing it in such a way that protects people's privacy. But the real problem is that they are failing to answer the single most important question of all. How? How are you doing this? They do not say. So there's no point in asking me how they could possibly do this, because I haven't a bloody clue. All we know is they're bragging about the ability to do this to people who buy ads off them.
Wow. Okay.
And all I can say is this icks me out no end.
Yeah.
Finally, I wish I could end on a good note after that. There are palate cleansers, by the way.
Good.
An ongoing trend I keep seeing. So I think it's become clear to everyone that the motor industry have done a terrible job at security. They've done the absolute worst possible thing, and they've rolled out internet connected things into cars and then tried to bolt on security later. Unfortunately, there is another industry that has done exactly the same stupid thing, and that is the medical industry of all things. So just another warning, security researchers investigated the security or not of pacemakers that can be controlled through RF. And what they found is that of the top four manufacturers, the things are riddled with bugs, which basically allow any controller to control any pacemaker. You can go onto PayPal and buy a controller for very little money, which you can then use to murder someone.
So you remember when we made the rules about Security Light that you weren't allowed to tell us about stuff unless you told us how to do something about it?
Right. What I'm saying is, I think it's important if you need to have a pacemaker installed that you discuss with your doctor whether or not you want a radio controllable one, or whether you want a more old fashioned one that doesn't have the convenience that someone can sort of point something at your chest to tweak at it, and that may require some more traditional interactions, because we've had pacemakers since before we've had these technologies.
What about a little shielding you could put over your chest?
Oh, that's a cool idea. You know, like the wallets for RFIDs.
Exactly. I just bought a purse with RFID blockage or whatever. And the problem is now I used to be able to walk up to my car and my car would unlock because my key was near it. Now it doesn't work as well.
Yes, Faraday cages, unfortunately, do indeed block all of the emissions and not just a few.
Yeah, I moved it to a different pocket and it seems to be okay now.
Ah, well, there we go. So this story moved between suggested reading and important security news about 5 times. And I decided in the end I was going to put it here because I think we do need to underline the point that if you're having some sort of medical device installed, this is actually a conversation you need to have with your doctor.
Yeah. And you're giving a good suggestion that maybe you don't want a radio controlled one until unless they define the ones that are safe.
Yeah. Well, The other thing I think is important is that I think this is a conversation you should have with your elected representative, because just like it's not legal to sell you rancid chicken, it shouldn't be legal to sell you security hole riddled pacemakers.
Medical devices, right?
Yeah, all medical devices. So I think that, you know, we have government regulations to protect us from poisoned water and from toxic food. I would like to be protected from broken medical devices, please. Now, again, I'm expressing a personal opinion here because I do believe that I believe in well-written regulation, and I believe the problem is bad regulation, not regulation. And I know that's not an opinion shared by the planet. I know there's people who believe that all regulation is bad, but my personal opinion is that what I want is an end to bad regulation and a focus on good regulation. And I will be writing to my elected representatives saying that I want them to hold the medical industry's feet to the fire. And I'm suggesting if anyone agrees with me, they do the same. And if they disagree with me, they do whatever they think is appropriate.
All right.
Notable breaches. I am treating these as part of suggested reading because I just can't, I'll be honest, I can't be bothered reading into them because there's so many of them all the time. So if any of these company names make your ears prick up, then the link is in the show notes and you can go RTFM, as it were. So, breach at DocuSign led to targeted email malware campaign. This story is notable in one sense. What we have here is not just potential damage. We have an actual wave of attacks that were the result of a breach. So this is a case of the possible damage being actual, which is not always true. Brooks Brothers have revealed that there was a theft of payment card information from their, I guess, their stores. And then some company called Molina Healthcare, M-O-L-I-N-A healthcare.com, sort of exposed patient records. So I'm hoping none of our listeners are those patients. But if that name rings a bell, link in show notes.
Yay! That was
now,
fun.
Now, suggested reading. Again, I'm going to point people to these rather than focusing on them.
But there's one more. Chipotle. Sure. Who cannot catch a break had their credit cards breached too.
Oh, goodness me. That one hadn't crossed my radar yet. That may be waiting in my RSS feed.
And they're calling it, they put the word E. coli in the name of the failure just to twist the knife a little bit further.
Oh, that's the last thing anyone working for Chipotle wants associated with their brand.
Yeah, so I will add that to the show notes.
Okay, do please. Oh, God. Yeah. The first suggested reading is one that we are putting in here because it's important and because you mentioned it last time that it was something Google had talked about and I hadn't had time to read up on it yet. And this is what Google called Project Treble, which is their re-architecting of Android O in such a way that it should be easier to get security updates through the Google process more quickly. It basically takes one of the middlemen between you and security updates out of the picture. And that's half as bad as things are at the moment. So I can't possibly say it's a bad thing that things have gotten twice as good. But I will point out that that removes half of the problems with Android. So Google still have another half to fix. So the problem is still that they've bypassed the hardware vendors, but not yet the cell carriers. The link from Google that explains what they've done is actually extremely human friendly. So I actually think people should read it because it's not jargon. It's actually sane and sensible and well explained by Google and not long.
And it's got pretty graphics too.
It does have pretty graphics with little Android robots getting sort of dressed up as they go through the process of going from a bare release to the final product. And my views on the matter are pretty much perfectly summed up by an op-ed from Ars Technica. So I've linked to that op-ed as the second suggested reading. That pretty much says what I want to say perfectly and better, more eloquently than I can. So just leave that there. We also talked last time about the Handbrake breach, where basically Handbrake's web server was hacked into and malicious variant of Handbrake, basically Handbrake with malware in it, was put up for download. There has been a very high-profile victim, which is unfortunately Panic Software, the makers of the wonderful Transmit app. They have lost control of some of their source code, which is basically an intellectual property loss. It's not a security issue as such. It's an IP loss for that company, and they lost it because someone downloaded Handbrake at exactly the wrong time. And because Handbrake always puts up the warning that it's not a signed app, no red flags were raised at any point, which I think we talked about last time. And the reason I think it's important to mention this is it's easy to go victim blaming, but sometimes it's actually the case that it's not that someone was stupid that they missed the red flags. Maybe there were no red flags. Or else the red flags were so small that it is entirely reasonable that even the most tech-savvy human beings could be tricked. So I know some people are always quick to blame the victim. I would say this is a salient example of extremely smart and extremely intelligent people falling prey to a well-thought-out cyber attack.
I do want to give a shout-out to Bradley Seppos, who works on Handbrake, which is not a paid-for app, so this guy works on his own time.
Yes, free open source.
And he wrote to me, I forget how he found it that I was talking about this, but he was great about responding to me. He wrote tons and tons and tons of stuff to me explaining the security breach. Actually, maybe he started it. Oh, no. Yeah, he found something on the podcast where I talked about it. And he gave us a lot of information about how it happened and what they're doing. And we had talked on here about the fact that they weren't a signed app. And he described some of the problems with being a signed app in their case. And they're actually working on an idea to sign together with VLC. Yeah. So maybe that'll be coming out. So I thought that was good.
Because open source isn't the same as open source. Right? Some open source projects have hundreds of people and massive resources and like budgets and money and stuff. And some open source projects are a guy or two guys. And while it's very easy for a massive project like VLC to get code signing set up, it's actually a big ask for a small project to set code signing set up. And so I love this idea that a big open source project could sort of spread its wings and help a smaller project out. And if they can come to an arrangement with VLC, I think that's absolutely wonderful.
Yeah. Yeah, I just thought it was really cool that he reached out to us and gave us a lot of information. And it came at a good time because I was writing an article about security things that are built into Mac OS for Don McAllister's Screencast Online magazine. And he wrote it at exactly the right time where I was able to correct some mistakes I would have made if he hadn't helped me out. So big shout out to Bradley.
Excellent. Cool. And I find it very hard to be too critical of open source people because, well, it's free. So who are we to demand they'd make it harder for themselves?
Right.
There are a bunch of show notes in the story together about the ongoing net neutrality situation in the US. I will leave that to people who are interested in that to go have a read. A related story is that the FCC, this is not really security related, but I think a lot of Americans probably should know about this. There's a push on to make it legal for telemarketers to intentionally bypass your telephone and go straight to spamming your voicemail. Not even ring your phone, just leave you spam voicemails. And for that to become legal and acceptable under FCC rules. If I were an American, I would definitely be making my voice heard on this, that I do not in any way, shape, or form condone this kind of thing becoming legal.
Yeah, I don't know whether it's true, but I heard that he said last week that he wasn't going to take into account the feedback that people have been giving about the net neutrality rule. So I don't know if he would read what we said about that either.
Possibly not, but it may be worth poking at your Congress critter as well.
Yeah.
You know, they need to know what makes you cranky.
Mm-hmm.
An interesting story that caught my eye. So the Senate obviously has staffers who obviously need to communicate with each other, and it's obviously really important they do so securely. So there's all sorts of rules on what Senate staffers can and can't use. And a person with a very archaic title, but actually a very important job, is called the Senate Sergeant at Arms. And it's not a guy with a gun or a guy who hands out guns. It's an office who look after all aspects of security, including certifying software as being acceptable for use by people in the Senate. And the Senate Sergeant at Arms has certified the Signal messaging app for use by Senate staffers.
Hmm.
So the reason is because Signal does secure, genuine end-to-end encryption, and Senate staffers need to be able to communicate securely. And so the Sergeant at Arms has approved it at the same time as a lot of those Senate staffers are working on legislation to make these kind of actually secure communications illegal, which the irony just sort of makes my jaw drop a little bit. Anyway, I think it's another vote of confidence in Signal is the positive take from this. A nice link on iMore. The title says it all. What to look for when choosing a VPN provider. If you're in the process of making that choice, that seems like a good thing to read. Related note from Ars Technica, how to build your own VPN if you're rightly wary of commercial options. That's, again, another option for the same choice. Facebook have said that they understand the problem of fake news and that they are working hard to tackle it. So The Guardian did an experiment to try to figure out whether or not they were succeeding. The Guardian have decided that, according to their reporting, it is not working. Facebook are not winning the battle. Whether they're fighting it or not is a different question, but they don't appear to be winning. The Boston Globe, in an attempt to make their paywall work, have disabled viewing their website when private browsing mode enabled, which is a bizarre side effect of a broken business model. So basically, you can't have any privacy because then you can read more than 10 free articles a month.
Hmm.
It's an interesting side effect to that whole business model. This is more one for people who are just curious as to what security researchers do. A really important technique for finding bugs is called fuzzing. And Naked Security have done one of periodically they just write an article that's not about news. It's just a description about how security researchers security research. And this is one of those articles. And it's called How Big Fuzzing Helps Find Holes in Open Source Projects. It's a good read if you're curious about how this stuff happens behind the scenes. For anyone in the European Union who is in some way responsible for an organization that is a corporation of some sort, it is a year from now that something called the GDPR is going into effect. This is a really quite scary piece of legislation that involves how you deal with users' privacy, and it opens your corporation up to massive fines if you're not in compliance that could bankrupt you easily. So if you are in the European Union and responsible for a corporation in some way, you should probably read about this if the GDPR is not already on your radar. You have a year. North Korea sanction monitors were actively attacked by a cyber attack, which is interesting. If you don't trust Facebook but still insist on using their app, there are some instructions from iMore on how to continue to use the app but disable your microphone so Facebook can't use your microphone, which may or may not be of interest to people. LastPass have made some changes that allow you to store in their cloud the two-factor auth style keys. It's a feature that, depending on your point of view, you're going to love or hate. And if you don't know whether you love or hate it, the Naked Security article in the show notes basically lays out the pros and cons. This is not a black and white question. This is a gray question. And everyone should make up their own mind on whether or not to use this feature, depending on their own needs, desires, and expectations and outlook on things. So I would say if you're a LastPass user and you're not sure whether or not to tick the new tick box you have, have a read and then make up your mind about taking the tick box you have.
Great, great. Good information.
Apple have released their latest six-monthly or biannual, I guess, privacy report. It hasn't really made the news because there's absolutely nothing of any surprise in here. More governments are asking for more stuff at pretty much the same growth rate as has been continuing before. If you would like to see the details, the PDF is linked in the show notes to Apple's report. If you are a user of a messaging app called Kik, there is a whole new cryptocurrency called KIN that is tied to this network. And if you are curious about it, there is a nice explanation of what it is and all about it over on TMO, and that is linked in the show notes. So that is all of your suggested reading. So now we can cleanse our little palates. First one is, if you're following along in Programming by Stealth and you've decided that all this JavaScript stuff is fun, but I am now such a great programmer, I'm ready to go off and write apps for iOS and OS X. Apple have made it easier for you by releasing as a free book in the iBook store, a curriculum for teaching Swift to school kids. So I figure if school kids can learn it, I can learn it. So there you go, link in show notes. The guys over in Bajango, they're a software company who make some apps I like, including Menus, I think is from Bajango. They've written some little sort of animated GIFs and some short descriptions showing you tricks for really quickly making common shapes in vector-based graphics packages, like, say, Affinity Designer that myself and yourself both love. So you can do things like, with like two or three clicks, make a love heart by making a V-shaped line and setting it to be really, really wide, and then you actually end up with a love heart shape just by the shape of the line with the rounded edges.
Oh, that is so fun. Oh, I'm watching it. That's awesome. Yeah.
So it's a whole bunch of these clever little tricks to get you to a bunch of common shapes you're likely to need really, really quickly and easily with vector-based editors. And of course, the same principles apply in every vector-based editor, so it doesn't matter which one you use. These videos are just as useful to you, so I thought they were worth listening to.
Oh, this is fantastic. So whenever Bart or Alistair host the show for me, I like to buy them a little present, and the present that I bought for Alistair was the workbook guide for Affinity Designer. And for some reason, I don't know why he started doing this, but it's been so much fun. He's been giving me lessons. Every day he mails me another lesson with little examples of how to do stuff. And this will be fun for him to get to see this one. I'm going to tell him I want all of the instructions to be animated GIFs too.
As nicely done as these ones here by Bajango. Yeah.
Yeah.
And finally, I just a link to a YouTube video. If you would like your jaw to be dropped and you just want to just amaze yourself at the creativity and geniusness of people, there is a hyperlapse video. So it's basically time lapse on steroids, which has some of the most amazing edits in it I've ever seen. And it involves a whole bunch of time lapse helicopter footage all stitched together of New York City. The thing goes at a New York City pace. It's completely in tune with the spirit of New York City. It is amazing. So that is linked. It's on YouTube. It's in like massive HD. I'm just like, yeah, I've had some fun with time lapse, but wow, this
is cool. I can't wait.
So
to see
many
it.
Shades of a new level. Oh, this is amazing. So drool over that.
All right. Well, that's probably enough.
Yeah. It's not as bad as last time, right?
Well, I don't know. It's an hour and 15 minutes, Bart.
Is it?
Yes. Oh, all right. Well, I wasn't ever bored. And so, like we always say, nobody ever said Security Light was too long.
That's a fair point. When the listeners start complaining, I'll start worrying about cutting it down. Although I will say there is more and more stuff going into suggested reading. So we're being more careful about what we highlight and what we just leave to people's discretion. So
there we go. All right. Well, we'll talk to you next time.
Yes, indeedy. And until then, stay patched and stay secure.
Well, that's going to wind us up for this week. Do not forget to send in your dumb questions, comments, and suggestions. You can email me at allisonpodfeet.com and follow me on Twitter at Podfeet. Remember, everything good starts with podfeet.com/something, podfeet.com/Patreon, podfeet.com/Facebook, podfeet.com/Google+, podfeet.com/Amazon. And if you want to join in the fun of the live show, but not next week, you can normally head on over to podfeet.com/live on Sunday nights at 5 p.m. Pacific time and join the friendly and enthusiastic Nozilla Castaways. Thanks for listening and stay subscribed.